Greetings and welcome to the second lecture on Megillat Esther. In the first lecture, back on Monday, I introduced Megillat Esther by going over some of the general overarching problems in the inclusion of Esther in the canon of Tanakh and the hot contest which accompanied that question, going as late as the 3rd century CE and perhaps even later. The problems in the text, which perhaps were the arguments against inclusion in the canon, such as the omission of God's name, the location being outside of Israel, without a framework of the land of Israel around it. For that, see the comments of the Kuzari in the second Ma'amar, chapter 2, paragraph 20 and on. And the almost deliberate avoidance of any mention of religious behavior or activity on the parts even of our heroes. Now, it's important to point out at this point that the text of Megillat Esther is one of the most troublesome texts that we have, perhaps the most troublesome text that we have in Tanakh for another reason. We are familiar with slight variations in some of the texts that we have in Tanakh. If we take a look at the earliest translations of the Tanakh that we have, the earliest translation of the Tanakh into any other language is the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim, or the Septuaginta, which was the translation of the Bible into Greek that happened in two phases in the 3rd century BCE. Ptolemy Philadelphus II, who was the Greek ruler in Egypt, in Alexandria, commissioned Jewish elders to translate the Chumash, the first five books of the Bible, into Greek. But subsequently, the Alexandrian Jewish community, which did not know Hebrew, many of the people did not know Hebrew, even some of their great scholars did not know Hebrew, for instance, Philo. Philo came along a little bit later. Commissioned the rest of the Bible to be translated into Greek, and thus we have the Septuagint, or the Septuagint, which is the called after the notion of the 70 elders who were involved in the translation of the Chumash. And the Septuagint, by and large, is a faithful translation. Here and there are phrases omitted, famously in Psalm 145, which is not Psalm 145. In the Septuagint, there is an extra line relative to what's in the Masoretic text. In the liturgy that we commonly refer to as Ashrei, which completes the acrostic and has a nun in it, there are several passages in the Septuagint which either omit or elide or enhance or augment verses in the Bible that are somewhat troublesome. An example is the first verse in Shmuel Aleph, the first book of Samuel, chapter 13, which is a very difficult verse to understand. It's just omitted in the Septuagint. In Judges, chapter 20, some of the numbers are modified so that the math of the members of the tribe of Benjamin that are killed in the war add up properly, etc. And that either means one of two things. It either means that the authors of the Septuagint, the translators, we're working from a different base text, a different vorlage, or else it means that they deliberately modified and changed the text to make it fit to, as it were, correct what they saw as either errors or just things that were too hard to understand. In any case, that is the case throughout the rest of the Bible, that the Septuagint is more or less a faithful translation. It's not a commentary. It is not an expansion. It is not like Josephus's Antiquities or like the famous Targumim. It is a translation. However, when we get to the book of Esther, the Septuagint is significantly longer. It has a preface, that is to say, there is a section of the book of Esther before where our story picks up, which involves Mordechai, and he has a dream, and he prays to God, etc. And there is also a coda. And by the way, in both the preface and the coda, God is there, and God's name is mentioned, and there's prayer, etc. There is even another text that exists called the Alpha text, which is even longer, in other words, which includes other sections which are not even the Septuagint. Now, what does that all mean? Does that mean that the text was troublesome as it was, if for the same reasons that we're troubled by it? because of the lack of religiosity and divinity, that at least in any explicit mention, and that the authors of the Septuagint and of the Alpha text try to enhance it that way? Does it possibly mean that the original text was a bit longer and that there are pieces of it that were excised for particular reasons? Unclear. We do have an interesting comment of Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, the 12th century Spanish exegete, who, commenting on the problem of the lack of the omission of God's name from anywhere in the text, has the following explanation. He says that the text of the Megillah, and there's no way to substantiate this, either pro or con, but he suggests that the text of the Megillah was a text that was propagated throughout the Persian Empire and was available for anyone, and the concern of the authors, meaning Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly who finally edited the text and published it, or even the concern of Mordechai and Esther, who published sort of an Ur text, an earlier text, was that Persians reading the text would then substitute God's name with a pagan name, and they did not want to be the cause of a pagan God's name being mentioned, and certainly not being mentioned as a savior. And therefore, they secularized the text, as it were. This is the Ibn Ezra's approach. It certainly is not a consensus. Many, many other approaches have been suggested. It is a thorny problem, as evidenced by the fact that almost every commentator on Megillat Esther grapples with the problem and suggests, sometimes very creatively, a solution, but it certainly is a problem. However, I think I can demonstrate, and we'll look a little ahead in the text, and I strongly suggest, unless you are driving right now or working out, that if you have a text available, to take a look with me in chapter 4 of Megillat Esther. I'd like to point out two places where it seems not only that God's name is avoided, but God's name seems to be deliberately excised from the text. In chapter 4, verse 14 stands as a very powerful verse, and we'll get to it probably in about 2 weeks when we get to that point in the text. But when Mordechai, through an agent, is urging Esther to go to the king to plead for her people, and Esther sends back the message that I can't go to the king, haven't seen the king in 30 days, everybody knows that if you go to the king without being summoned, you die, unless the king favors you, and I don't think he will, etc. He says back as follows, Ki machareish tacharishi ba'et hazot, if you are silent at this moment, Revach v'hatzalah ya'amod la'yehudim mi, and I'm going to stop at that point. Salvation will come to the Jews from, and we know what the answer to that is. We know what the next word should be. From God, from heaven, from the divine. And instead, the words put into Mordechai's mouth, and I'll explain what I mean by that, are mimakom acher, from another place. In other words, if you don't save, salvation will come from somewhere else. But it's quite clear that to any Jew living in the 6th century, 5th century BCE, and any Jew throughout most of history, when they claim an absolute belief in the eternity of the Jewish people and say that if you're not the one to save, then salvation will come from somewhere else, what they mean is that God is watching out for the Jewish people and God will save. And yet Mordechai's words are salvation will come from somewhere else. The reason I say these are the words that are put into Mordechai's mouth is, as I mentioned last time, every conversation that we read in the Megillah is a translation. There is no single conversation anywhere in the Megillah that takes place between two Jews. Even if you would argue that the two Jews who are both Persian-born would be speaking in Hebrew, which there is no reason to think that, but even if that were the case, there is no such conversation. And this conversation taking place between Mordechai and Esther is taking place through an intermediary that we have every reason to believe is a young Persian eunuch working in the women's quarters of the palace. And therefore, the authors, the editors, when they translate whatever it is that Mordechai said to Esther, that's the way that they translate it. And they deliberately seem to excise God's name from the conversation. There's another point at which something similar happens later on in that chapter in the penultimate verse. In verse 16, it says as follows. Esther is convinced by Mordechai's argument, and Esther says to Mordechai, Lech knoset kol ayudim anzim shushan, gather all of the Jews who are in Shushan, fast for me for 3 days and day and night. I and my maidens will similarly fast. And I will come to the king against protocol And if I'm lost, I'm lost. Well, that's a beautiful description, but the main piece here is missing. I'm going to fast, you're going to fast, everybody's going to fast, we're all going to fast for 3 days, and then I'll come to the king. But what is the purpose of fasting? Within Jewish tradition, and this is certainly something that the Jews in the 5th century BC were familiar with, as is evidenced by a period piece, which is the book of Ezra, where fasting is always accompanied and is a vehicle for sincere prayer and reflection and repentance, etc. And there's none of that. Fasting is mentioned here almost as a mechanical piece. We'll fast, and hopefully that'll work. But it should be clear that that's not what Esther's intent is, that we'll fast, and in the meantime, just go about our business and not reflect upon who we are. But rather, that fasting will be accompanied by tshuva and tefillah and staka, etc., all of the vehicles that we normally employ to try to create inner change and a turn in our hearts towards God, etc. And yet that's excised from the text. So there seems to be a clear program, a clear agenda on the part of the editors of the text to make sure that Megillat Esther avoids a direct mention of God or of relationship to God. And again, the fact that it does show up in these other texts, in the Septuagint version and the Alpha text, only highlights the problem of how we deal with, as we refer to it, MT, the Masoretic text, the text that we have in our Tanakh, in which all of these things are omitted. We will flesh this out more over time, but now it's time for us to go back to chapter 1, to verse 5, where we left off last time, and begin studying, resume studying the text. Again, in the first four verses, we are presented with Ahasuerus's grand party, and we ask the questions about why the focus on this. And again, as a Tanakh reader, and it's important to note that the book of Esther is really directed to several different audiences simultaneously. It's directed modularly and globally, if you will, meaning it is directed to an audience that's reading the text in Hebrew or in another language, perhaps in a translation, as an independent modular text. It's a story about palace intrigue. It carries many sophisticated and complex psychological lessons and observations. It says much about pride and about anger and about security and about paranoia. It says much about these things. However, that's all taken out of the context of Tanakh. Once it's seen within the context of Tanakh, to read it, if you will, globally, gives a whole different picture. And that's where so much of the issues of language, and as I mentioned last time, the fact that Esther is such a late text relative to the rest of Tanakh, means that the authors get to utilize all of the earlier texts and use Esther almost as a mirror or as a midrashic mirror on those earlier texts to compare, to contrast, to create allusions, etc. That is something that appears very powerfully at the beginning of the Megillah, as I mentioned, with the mention of the Birah, Shushan HaBirah, the mention of the 7 days and the Miluim, and all associated with the Mishkan. And now I'd like to expand upon that for a couple minutes before fully resuming into the text. Any reader of Tanakh that opens up a book and says, the king, the great king, the king who rules the world, is immediately offended. Because we know who the king is. We know who the king is who rules the world. The king who rules the world is God. And we read the Birah. We know the Birah is the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. And suddenly we've got some faux king who has trouble, as I mentioned last time, even sitting on his own throne. It takes him 3 years or into his third year. He rules over the world as it is. But as we will find out soon enough, he can't even rule over his own family. And he has trouble ruling over his own provinces. And we can already get a sense that there's something not right here, as if to say there is a wonderful, beautiful facade, and behind it something very, very horribly and fetid is festering, which we are about to uncover, and we will see it as we go by. Verse 5. When these days were up, the 6 months, the king made a feast for everyone in Shushan for 7 days. As I mentioned last time, these 7 days, again, seem to parallel the 7 days of the dedication of the inauguration, as it were, of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. And why did he make this party? It seems quite clear, and the rabbis point this out in Masachet Megillah, that his thinking was that first he has to make a big party for all of his politicos and his machers, his financial backers, and his army officers, so that they will have allegiance to him. And at the very end of the party, he wants to generate loyalty among the people who live in the town where his capital is, just been moved to, Shushan, so that they will have loyalty towards him. So if there is any sort of an insurgency, any sort of rebellion, they will remain loyal to the king. So he made this party. And now we get a blow-by-blow description, which between you, me, and the wall, I have no idea why we would care about it, except that we will care about it. But reading the text, we're caught really by surprise. Why are we given such a description? We are not given such a description of Nebuchadnezzar's palace. We are not given such a description of Hiram's palace. We're certainly not given such a description of Pharaoh's palace. And we are there much of the time in Egypt. And yet we're not given such descriptions. Why are we given such a description about Ahasuerus's palace and the splendor? So let's read the words, and I will inflect a little differently when keywords show up. Chur, which is white. Chur karpas utchelet. So white cotton and tchelet. Pay attention to that word. Tchelet, royal blue. Achuz bechav levutz. So now we're describing the curtains. So the curtains are white cloth or white cotton, which is held up together with ropes of linen, v'argaman, and royal purple. Boots and argaman. Aglile chesef, and they're on rollers that are made of silver, v'amude shesh, and pillars of marble. This is quite extravagant. Mitod zahava chesef, the beds that the guests were lying on, reclining on while they were eating, were made of gold and silver. Aritzfat bahat vashesh v'dar v'socharet, on a floor that had all sorts of inlaid jewels in them. Listen to these words. Tchelet, argaman, boots, zahav, kesef. These are all words that I, as a Tanakh reader, I'm familiar with because in Exodus 25, that's part of the list of materials that were collected and then later in subsequent chapters that were used to create the building of and the appurtenances of the vessels used for the tabernacle that was first in the desert and then in Jerusalem. So we have, as it were, not only the Megillah as what I referred to last time as the anti-Tanakh, we now have, if you will, a building that is the anti-Mikdash, the shadow temple in another place, using all of the same materials. The rabbis, indeed, following the Midrash Seder Olam, which I mentioned last time, that posits that the materials of the Mikdash were still in Babylonian and now Persian hands, and the Mikdash had not yet been rebuilt, maintained that Ahasuerus, and they maintain this, I believe, homiletically, that Ahasuerus at his party deigned to put on the vestments of the priests, the Bigdei Kehuna, and that he served, as we see in the next pasuk, Vahashkot Bichlei Zahav Echelim Mikelim Shonim, he served the wine in all sorts of different vessels, and Chazal say, what are those vessels? Those are the vessels of the temple. Again, as I mentioned last time, that is very troubling in light of the verse in the first chapter of Ezra where it indicates that Koresh, earlier, had already taken all the vessels out of Nebuchadnezzar's temple and given them to the agent who was going to lead the Jewish return, Shesh Batzar, and so all of those vessels are already gone. Homiletically, the rabbis are saying so, and I'll explain why I believe they're saying so against the historic record. That he used these kelim. And indeed, the common custom is that those three words, v'chelim, mekelim, shonim, are read not in the festive Esther cantillation, but rather in the mournful lamentation cantillation. V'chelim, mekelim, shonim. And to indicate that the idea that these are the vessels of the temple that are now being used at this laggard's party, in Shushan. And there is much, much royal wine, as much as the king can afford, which is endless. And one more verse, and then we'll sum up this section. Now, the word dat, which in modern Hebrew means religion, and in medieval Hebrew, in some contexts, actually means tenets or beliefs. in its original uses, its Persian word that comes to us through this period, comes into Tanakh and chiefly through the Megillah, the word dat means protocol, the proper way things are done. And now we find out, what is the first item of protocol? And protocol is going to play a critical role in this entire story. The word shows up over 20 times in the Megillah. Hashtiyach adat enones. What is the first bit of protocol we hear about? Well, there's two components to it that make us cringe. Because we're familiar with protocol when it comes to a palace. If we're looking at this as compared to or contrasted with the tabernacle and the temple, we know that there's protocol around the temple. That protocol is issues of life and death. Someone who is impure may not go in. Someone who is not a Kohen may not go in, etc. And the punishment for that in many cases is very, very severe. And there is no wiggle room. As the Talmud relates, even David, king of Israel, had no right to go into the temple because he was not a Kohen. And yet, what is the first rule we hear about? Well, the first rule we hear about is it's a rule about drinking. Shtiyach hadat. And what is the rule? The rule is there's no rule. Hashtiyach hadat enones. What the drinking was according to protocol. What's the protocol? Nobody's forced, which means drink however much you want or however little you want and whatever kind of wine you want. So we see a kingdom which is filled with the facade and the glory, the gold and the silver and all of this lavish material, and the rules that govern it are about partying. And what are the rules? Are there are no rules. So we immediately get a very strong sense, as I mentioned, that there is something very wrong about this presentation, and we have yet to uncover it. So in our first paragraph, which is the first verse, 8 verses, it's really an exposition, a presentation of Ahasuerus and his grandeur. We already get hints, as I mentioned last time, of his insecurity, the difficulty he has with establishing his kingdom and establishing his rule. And then we're given a description of these lavish parties that he throws, 2 grand parties, one for all of his leadership and then one for everybody in Shushan for 7 days. And a beautiful, gorgeous description of the environs of the party and then of the drinking at the party. It's very nice. At least that's the sense we get. And the king had commanded that every butler should serve every man exactly the way he wants. Now, by the way, this is an interesting point that we get, kirtzon ish va'ish. That we have a lavish party, and the party is chiefly for all of the officers, etc. And we're trying to picture this party. What does the party look like? So many of us grew up in a traditional setting and are familiar with the story of Esther from the time that we were little children, have a picture of a big feast, and there are men there, there are women there, there's perhaps over abundance of drinking and of drunkenness, perhaps some licentiousness, perhaps there's some pagan rituals going on, and we see in the middle of it the fat, jolly, drunk Ahasuerus. Well, we have no reason to think he's fat. We have no reason to think he's drunk. There's no indication in the text that he's drunk. Jolly, perhaps. Happy, certainly at some points, but not all the time. But the critical piece that we miss is that we always picture ourselves seeing Ahasuerus. As we will see later on the text, you don't see Ahasuerus. Only a few select individuals get to see him at all. They are called Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech, the ones who see the face of the king. Everyone else doesn't see Ahasuerus. He's behind a curtain somewhere. He's in a private room somewhere. That's one piece of the puzzle. The other piece of the puzzle becomes very clear in the text is this was a man's only party. Now, there's several ways to dissect that. One way to understand it is that this party was really sort of a networking piece, meaning all of the officers and all of the governors and all of the wealthy power brokers had gathered together. And that was an opportunity for them to swap information, to exchange ideas, to tell stories, etc., about how things were going for them. That's one possibility. And it seems to be the easiest possibility to read in the text. The second possibility is something that's a little bit less noble, perhaps. And that is that perhaps this was a party where the wives were deliberately uninvited because perhaps there was another form of entertainment that men would not want to be enjoying while their wives were present. But in any case, one thing is clear. This was a man's only party, And at the same time, there was a women's only party taking place. And that, for that we read at the beginning of verse 9. Gam Vashti Amalka Asta Mishtei Nashim. So Vashti, who we now hear about, who is the queen, made a women's party. Beit HaMalchut Ashal HaMelech Hashverosh. It was within the palace grounds, in the Beit HaMalchut, in the royal house, that belonged to Ahasuerus, which means she's on his territory. Well, that's appropriate. And this is a women's party. Now, that is a piece of foreshadowing. In Hebrew, we call it hatrama. It's foreshadowing because our camera from verse 2 has been on the man's party. The king made a party, and we see a description of it, and we're following, as it were, the camera that pans the curtains and the rods and the beds and the floor, and then the stewards serving the wine. It's all at that party. And then we get sort of a little bit of an interruption. Oh, there's a women's party taking place somewhere else. Now let's go back to the man's party, which immediately makes us question, so why are you telling me about the women's party? Well, the women's party is going to become important very soon. Bayom HaShvi'i. Bayom HaShvi'i means the seventh day, meaning the seventh day of the Shushan party, which means today is the climax of the entire project. There's been a six-month party for all of the officers, and now a seven-day party for everybody in Shushan. This is it. This is the last day. Which means that everything that Ahasuerus has invested, financially, emotionally, politically, emotionally perhaps not, but financially and politically, in this party is now coming to a head. All of the goodwill, all of the allegiance, all of the respect and perhaps even fear that he is trying to garner among his subjects is now coming to a head. The king was feeling good with wine. That does not mean drunk. Check out, for instance, the book of Ruth, chapter 3, verse 7. You'll see that Boaz, who was a hero in the story, and we certainly don't picture him as a drunk, is also called Tov Lev Bayayin. He has dinner, he has some wine, and he's feeling pretty happy. Tov Lev HaMelech Bayayin, he was feeling good. Amar Lim Human Bistacha Ranabi Tava Vagtazi Tava Chakas. These are seven Persian names. Shivat HaSarisim. We'll talk about the word Saris in a second. Seven of the Sarisim. Hamashartim Epnei HaMelech Hashverosh. That serve the face of the king of Ahasuerus. That's an important phrase. Now the word Saris, in rabbinic Hebrew and in modern Hebrew, means a eunuch. Somebody who either because of an operation, because of some medical reason, either from birth, does not have certain male sexual characteristics, and as a result of that is unable to perform sexually. Eunuchs, as we know in the ancient world and even in the medieval world, were often either made that way or deliberately selected in order to serve in the courts to be able to be around the women so that there would not be any inappropriate dalliances. However, that's not what the word saris means originally. Saris comes from the Sumerian word, which means effectively shel rosh in Hebrew, meaning it is somebody who serves the head. A saris, therefore, is not a derogatory term, but rather it's an honorific term in which the saris is somebody who serves directly the head of state. And therefore, these seven sarisim, who serve, as it says, the face of the king Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus appeals to them. And what does he say? Lahaviyat Vashti Amalka lifnei HaMelech b'cheter Malchut. To have Vashti, the queen, brought before the king with her crown. Now, the way that it is read midrashically, in one version, that means in her crown and nothing but the crown. In other words, to have her come out naked. When we get to the beginning of chapter 2, we'll talk about where that midrash comes from and what the significance of it is. But the simple read of the text is to have her come out with all of her royal finery. Why? Laharot, to show off. Now remember that word we had at the beginning of the party. In verse 4, Vaharoto, as he was showing off. So now he has come to the climax, he wants to show off the finest thing he has. Not just the gold and the silver and the curtains, but the finest thing he has is his beautiful wife Vashti. Laharot ha'amim v'asarim et yofya, to show the nations and the ministers her beauty. Kitovat marehi, because she indeed was very beautiful. And now crisis happens. Now we have to pay attention. Again, we have to picture the scene. And as I wrote in the first couple of chapters of my book, Between the Lines of the Bible, in order to read Tanakh, especially to read narrative in Tanakh, you have to go into the scene and be one of the actors in the scene in your imagination to understand what's going on. Look around you. See who's there. See who hears what. See who's watching. See who's present to get a proper picture. How do we picture the request made of Vashti? At least for many of us growing up, the way that we kind of had the picture happen was that the king sent a message, meaning a note, or somebody came and whispered in her ear, or somebody came to her private quarters and said, the king wants you to come out. And of course, we were told the king wants you to come out naked, etc. And Vashti says no. But that's not what happened here. That's not the text. The text says that she has having a party for all the women, and seven men, walk into her party. Now, if seven men walk into a women's only party and they're ministers and they're agents of the king, you can very well be sure that all of the women stop whatever they're doing and they are very curious, they want to know what's happening, and they listen to the message, which means that when these seven men come and they announce in front of this party to Vashti, the king requests your presence with all your royal finery, and then she refuses, this is now a public humiliation of the king, and it is, in a sense, tearing apart everything that he has tried to build up for the last 6 months plus, because just imagine, some of these governors and officers who are there till the end, at the next day, go to pick up their wives and say it's time to go back home to the provinces. And the king says, you know, it's a very impressive party. And the wife says, what do you mean impressive? The king sent a message for Vashti to come, and Vashti said no, and it was public, and it was humiliation. And suddenly the fabric of all of this buildup and all of this respect that the king was trying to create now comes unwoven very quickly. That is the threat. In the next shiur, in the next lecture, we will talk about how that threat is allayed by the advice of one of his ministers. But in any case, to finish this section, Vatvayena Malka Vashti lavo bidvar hamelech. Notice the words. The queen Vashti refused to come at the beckon of the king. Asher biyad hasarisim, that was given through the agency of these sarisim. In other words, it wasn't a quiet SMS message. She got on her cell phone and punched back N-O. This was a public request that she publicly refused to accede to. Vayitzof ha-melech meod, the king is very angry, v'chamato ba'aravo, his anger seethed inside of him. We understand why his anger seethed inside of him. Because, again, he's building up, he's investing in all of this goodwill, and at the very climax of it, when he's going to show off the most beautiful thing he has, which is his queen, and later on we'll get into his misogyny, and we'll understand that better at the beginning of chapter 2, which will take us back to rereading this passage. At that exact point, Vashti publicly humiliates him, thus threatening to tear down all of the goodwill he has been building up. Over the course of this last half hour, we took a look and reviewed a few of the general issues of that bother us in the Megillah, looked at the, as it were, deliberate excision of God's name and God's presence from the Megillah. We talked about some of the alternative texts, the Septuagint, the Alpha text, and nonetheless, our focus, of course, on the Masoretic text, on the text that we have with Esther, the 10 chapters that we have. And then we continued studying and finished the first paragraph, which described the party. And then we read the second paragraph of the Megillah, which took us all the way until the 12th verse of the first chapter. And God willing, in next installment, which will be on Monday, we will continue from here and complete the first chapter and see sort of what happens to Vashti. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos.